Let's just say you needed surgery on your hand or something, you broke a bone in your hand. You probably want the specialist who has been doing that their whole life. But if that person knows all about hand surgery, like you're not gonna look at them and be like, hey, by the way, can you give me some advice on like nutrition and diet and like sleep and light and circadian rhythm? Like, unfortunately, we do that sometimes. It's like, oh, they're a doctor, they must know everything. And we kind of do that, like, oh, they're on Wall Street, they must know how the monetary system works. But the reality is, no, they don't. They're coming into work, they do this specific thing. And most people, unless it's a personal interest for them, they don't analyze the system as a whole. The punchline for me is all roads lead to currency debasement. And I don't want to be so definitive about it. Like, is it technically possible for the US fiscal situation to get in order and the central bank to stop manipulating interest rates and never increase their balance sheet again? Like, yeah, I suppose that's technically possible, but I think that's an extremely low likelihood. What would have happened to your passive investment in 2008 if the Fed didn't step in, if the fiscal policy didn't step in with major bailouts? What would have happened again in 2020 if we didn't get fiscal and monetary bailouts? You would have lost your shirt. You would have had certain investments that just went to zero. The only reason why stocks have performed the way they have, 10 to 15% on average for the last, whatever, 15 years, is because of those bailouts. So you are making a conscious bet that every time there's a big issue in the markets, the Fed and the Treasury are gonna come in and support it, support the markets. You might be correct in that. And that's why, you know, I think people are okay owning stocks. But what are the effects of the Fed and the Treasury bailing out markets every time? They do that by monetary expansion. So if that's your assumption going forward, don't you wanna own the asset that's going to benefit the most from monetary expansion?
If you enjoy this podcast and you want to learn more about Bitcoin, then make sure to subscribe to our free newsletter. Every Friday, we send out insights into macro, Bitcoin on-chain, and Bitcoin mining. Join over 100,000 existing subscribers by clicking the link in the description or going to newsletter.blockwareintelligence.com. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Blockware Podcast. This week, I have on John Haar from Swan. John, thank you for joining us.
Hey, Mitch. Great to be here, man. Excited to get into it.
Me too. So, first things first, you did 13 years at Goldman Sachs, and that's quite the contrast from what you do now, working with Swan, building the Orange Brick Road, the Bright Bitcoin future. So can you explain or just talk about your career at Goldman Sachs, what you learned, and then how did you inevitably end up switching over to Bitcoin?
Yeah, so did 13 years working on Wall Street. I've got the slick back hair and the vest to prove it. In case anyone doubts it. So it was a good experience. You know, I learned a lot. Started working there in 2009, right as the financial crisis. Wall Street was kind of coming out of the financial crisis, and then left in early 2022 to join Swan. So I actually worked at Goldman Sachs that whole time. Did a few different things while I was there. I did institutional sales. I was always in the asset management division, I should have said first. Did institutional sales, so covering large clients who invested in all different types of asset classes through Goldman Sachs Asset Management. And then I switched over to the portfolio management side, specifically fixed income. So the very exciting world of bonds. I focused on corporate bonds for a while and then moved up to like a bigger picture view, looking at the entire fixed income portfolio, all different types of bonds. And so I did that for like 9 years and the first job for like 4 years. But how did that lead me to Swan? Because most of my former colleagues think I'm crazy, as you're probably surprised to hear. It led me to Swan because it actually goes back to the financial crisis for me. Graduating in 08-09, being my senior year, was a crazy time to graduate, especially if you have a finance degree. You're literally thinking, oh, maybe I'll go work at that bank, you know, when this year's over and the bank, you know, doesn't exist. And you're wondering if Citi is still going to exist and JP Morgan and Wells and Goldman. You're like, I don't even know what bank's going to exist, let alone where I'm going to work. So I was very fortunate to get a job after college, but one of the things that happened in my senior year was you just couldn't help but look at what was going on and say, okay, there's a lot of people who I thought were the experts. I thought they were the adults in the room, whether it was Ben Bernanke's kind of like the biggest culprit, but Hank Paulson, Treasury Secretary, whether it's Congress who supposedly oversees the banking sector, whether it's bank CEOs who are supposed to have a good grip on their companies, whether it's the financial media, Bloomberg and CNBC, nobody knew what was going on. Very few people saw the financial crisis coming. Very few people could even make sense of it as it was happening. So for me, that was like a huge light bulb moment. And I just said, okay, I'm a 20-year-old college kid. I'm just watching at this point. I don't think I understand what's happening, but I'm just observing. And one of those observations is, okay, this chair of the Federal Reserve, the central bank, is saying things about the financial system, which are literally being proven incorrect days or weeks later. So for me, it was just like, okay, I don't think they know what's going on, so I'm going to look elsewhere for answers. And long story short, that led me to Austrian economics and the Mises Institute at Mises.org. I did just a huge deep dive throughout like 09, 10, 11 on Austrian economics, sound money, the gold standard. One of my huge takeaways there was, why did I not learn about this at all in school? You know, no one tells you about sound money. Austrian economics is not even a term you hear. And I'm taking finance and economics classes, so it's not like I was a, you know, literature major. So that was a huge light bulb moment. I'm reading about it. It actually makes sense to me. It's not until 2013 that I hear about Bitcoin just from a friend. And this part I always stress to people, because a lot of times I'm telling them this story and they're like, oh, you should have gotten Bitcoin right from the start. Like, you were into Austrian economics and sound money. And I was able to see that their goal was to do digital sound money. But unfortunately, my next thought was, that'll never catch on. And I just figured it was so hard to get people to understand the gold standard that they were never going to go for the digital version of the gold standard. And then also in 2013, there were tons of frictions. It was much harder to actually acquire Bitcoin. I didn't really know what I was going to do with it when I got it. If Coinbase even existed, the idea,
I think it was just
like,
Mt. Gox back then.
Yeah, yeah. It might have been just been Mt. Gox. If Coinbase was close, the thought of like giving your banking information to them was very weird. The thought of putting $100 bills in a Bitcoin ATM was very weird. So I just said, I'll pass on it. And it took me over 4 years. It wasn't until late 2017, that mainstream bull run, where I said, okay, this is maybe a thing, because we're talking about it on the floor at Goldman. They're talking about it on CNBC and Bloomberg. And then I got involved personally, started learning more about it. So I just stress that to people, because, and I try to remind myself that if you're talking to someone who you feel like they should grasp the significance of Bitcoin and sound money, I look back at myself and say, hey, you were reading about Austrian economics for 3 years, and it took you another 4 years to even come around to the idea that Bitcoin is important. So patience is definitely warranted in those situations. And then just rounding it out, basically, I came across Swan at 2020, 2021 at some point. And the more people I met from Swan, the more impressed I was with the company. And then eventually I said, you know what, I think it would make a lot of sense to make the leap from Wall Street career to Swan. And yeah, coming up on the 2 year mark at Swan.
That's awesome, man. I really enjoyed hearing your story. And there's a few points there I want to dive into. It's fascinating. I would almost actually say I sort of had a similar epiphany in college. I was studying economics and I was considering the banking route. And there wasn't the 2008 financial crisis, but we had Jerome Powell saying inflation would be transitory. And I just knew that's not going to happen. They just printed a boatload of money. It's not going to happen. So he doesn't know anything. The entire traditional financial apparatus seems to not understand hard money. And I started diving into Saifedean. And so next thing I know, I'm looking for a Bitcoin job straight out of college. How do you see the perception of Bitcoin within traditional finance? And how has that changed over time? Because a phrase that rings true to me is like, the people who need Bitcoin the least and who benefit the most from the current system, they tend to take a long time to understand it, right? People in third world countries who have massive inflation, they're really far away from the money printer, they get Bitcoin quickly. But people like Goldman Sachs, that's about as close to the money printer as you can get. So how did their perceptions change? Were you, as you were sort of going down the rabbit hole, were you able to talk to your colleagues about this and get actual high level in discussion? And then how do they perceive it now, if you're still in touch with any of those guys?
Yeah, overall, they're not very receptive to it. Like you said, I think they're going to be one of the last groups to come around to it. There's a few people here and there who may have been like, okay, I kind of see why the gold standard makes sense. I kind of understand what you're talking about with sound money and central banks can be irresponsible. Like they kind of get it, but that's the exception. And even those people are not like fully diving into it. They're more like, oh, maybe it makes a little bit of sense. The vast majority of people on Wall Street are just not open to the idea of sound money. And that makes them not even look into Bitcoin further from like a technical perspective and like understanding the network and the protocol and like, why do I believe my funds are secure? If I take self-custody of them, how do I send a transaction? They never even get to that point because their view is sound money is a bad idea to begin with. So why would I even want to involve myself with this fixed supply monetary network? You know, they repeat the things that I think are absolutely flawed, such as the government must issue money, or we need more units of money to create economic growth. They believe those things totally. So they just don't look into it. And then just another thing that I would say is true about people on Wall Street. I like to give this analogy to specialists on Wall Street, because that's what most of them are. And like a specialist in the field of healthcare, like healthcare providers. So most people who work on Wall Street, they got hired to do a very specific job, whether it is manage a portfolio of corporate bonds like I did, whether it's, you know, advise on mergers and acquisitions, whether it's underwrite new deals that you're IPO type things that you're bringing to the market. It's a very specific thing that they come in and do. And to be fair, they get good at it. They get good at the process. They know all the jargon. They know their client base. They know how to execute. But that doesn't mean they have spent any time looking at the system as a whole. And a lot of those people, they just want to go to work, do their job, make what is a pretty nice salary for most people who work at those big Wall Street banks, and then go home and, you know, support their family. That's what most people, their attitude is. They're not looking to sit at home and say, let me analyze how this system works as a whole. And then my view would be, even if they did do that, they would realize that the big banks benefit from the existing system. So number one, most never even get there. But if they do, they don't want to do anything about it because they don't want to change it. And the analogy that I mentioned was to the healthcare profession would be like a specialist. Let's just say you needed surgery on your hand or something. You broke a bone in your hand. You probably want the specialist who has been doing that their whole life for a decade, 2 decades, 3 decades, whatever. But if that person knows all about hand surgery, like you're not going to look at them and be like, hey, by the way, can you give me some advice on like nutrition and diet and like sleep and light and circadian rhythm? Like, unfortunately, we do that sometimes. It's like, oh, they're a doctor. They must know everything. And we kind of do that like, oh, they're on Wall Street. They must know how the monetary system works. But the reality is, no, they don't. They're coming into work. They do this specific thing. And most people, unless it's a personal interest for them, they don't analyze the system as a whole. So that would, those are some like major takeaways. And then just real quick on how their views have kind of changed over time. I do think that they're coming around to Bitcoin, but they're like either not admitting it or just very slowly admitting it. Because I was there in 2017 having these conversations firsthand, and they would repeat the, you know, lines, oh, it's just for money laundering. Oh, it's just for gambling. It's just for speculating, whatever. And then like 5 years later, they're not really saying that as much. And they're saying like, oh, it's just correlated with Fed policy. And like, why don't you just own a tech stock instead? Or the government's going to shut it down. And you, I look at that and I'm like, okay, are you guys not aware of how your own criticism is changing? That means your viewpoint is changing. If you go from saying something's a scam and a Ponzi scheme and only used for illicit activities, and then your next point is like, oh, it's correlated with tech stocks. It's like, whoa, you just made a major change in your view here. But they don't really give Bitcoin that credit. So that makes me optimistic because that was only over 5 years. So I think in the next 5 years, you'll see more institutional Wall Street acceptance of it. Whether they admit that they were wrong in the past or not, I think you'll see more acceptance of it.
That's a really good point. Their framework is shifting and they don't even realize it. And I think a key idea that you hit on there was that Bitcoin is very, it encompasses a lot of intellectual domains. And so when you're so specialized on one specific niche, you know, you don't have time to go and dig into the how or the why behind Bitcoin, right? You need to understand the history of money. You need to understand why governments shouldn't intervene in markets. You need to understand computer science. You need to understand game theory. There's so many different elements that comprise Bitcoin. When you're just focused on your one specific craft, especially as when it's in traditional finance, you really don't see that need as much as other people who are, you know, maybe more open-minded and have a wider range of topics that they understand.
For sure, for sure. And that to me is why Bitcoin is endlessly fascinating, because it's not just the price. It's not just, it's not even just economics. Economics is a huge part of it. But like you said, economics, monetary history, geopolitics, game theory, obviously cryptography, the underlying tech, computer science.
Energy grids too.
Energy grids, another huge one. Like there's multiple sub rabbit holes within the Bitcoin rabbit hole that this is why now I'm spending so many of my waking hours learning and reading and talking about Bitcoin, because to me it's just endlessly fascinating. There's so many different subtopics within it.
Yeah, it never ends. I haven't found the bottom of the rabbit hole, and I don't know anyone who has. And another point you made there that I think is fascinating. These Wall Street guys, they're like, oh, it's just correlated with Fed policy. It's like, that is a big deal. This is the asset that is, not only is it correlated with Fed policy, but it is the most correlated with Fed policy, right? When there's monetary expansion, when the money supply is increasing, Bitcoin goes up the most. And then on the other side of that, when the monetary supply contracts during the brief periods of austerity and high rates, it goes down more than other assets. But as you and I probably both agree on, over the long run, they have to continue to expand the money supply. And I think this is where we can start diving into sort of current day macro. How are you looking at the broader macroeconomic picture? We can start with the bird's eye view. You know, what went down in the last, say, 2-3 years? And then what do you expect over the next year, 2 or 3 years?
Yeah, for sure. So I think bigger picture, like you were alluding to, the punchline for me is all roads lead to currency debasement. And I don't want to be so definitive about it. Like, is it technically possible for the U.S. fiscal situation to get in order and the central bank to stop manipulating interest rates and never increase their balance sheet again? Like, yeah, I suppose that's technically possible, but I think that's an extremely low likelihood. So the alternative of that is all roads lead to currency debasement over the long term. You do have these brief periods of time where that train goes in reverse, but not for too long of a period. And I think 2022 was one of those periods. Not even all of 2022. It was probably like, you know, 9 months of 2022, roughly. And I think we're starting to come out of that on the other side. So, you know, if you can time those reversals and, you know, buy and sell at the right time, like, okay, you're pretty good there. But long term, the trend has not really changed. And I'm talking in terms of monetary expansion here.
Right.
In terms of various asset classes, there definitely are some things to consider, I think. And that can kind of get us into like, what do I think are the big things that have changed in the macro picture? So if you look at like the last 30 years, what has the macro environment been characterized by? It's like relatively low inflation, declining interest rates, rising equity valuations. So that means mostly positive returns for stocks and bonds. Then you have increasing globalization. So cheap stuff from China, cheap natural gas from Russia. Supply chains are built for efficiency rather than resilience, you know, offshoring instead of onshoring. Not really major conflicts between the world's most powerful nations. And then U.S. dollars and treasuries being the primary reserve asset. So pretty much anyone who follows markets and geopolitics even a little bit would hear that list and be like, okay, I think most of those things are showing signs of reversing now, if not all of them. So I would just caution people to say the things that you think should have worked or things that did work over the last 30 years, they might not work the same way going forward. So like 60-40 portfolio, set it and forget it. It's you know, provides whatever 8-10% on average returns with a certain amount of volatility. That might not be the case going forward. Because now we're in an environment where you look at the fiscal situation and you say, okay, this isn't really like fiscal and monetary. This isn't really like what we've seen in the past 30 years. So what is it like? And I think, you know, a Bitcoiner and investment researcher, Lynn Alden, who, you know, is near and dear to everyone's hearts in the Bitcoin community, she does a great job saying the best analogy is the 1940s. We've taken on a ton of debt, and effectively you need to get out of that debt. Debt to GDP ratios are very high. There's a few different ways you can get out of it. And the ways we got out of it in the 1940s were we did some sort of financial repression. So you keep interest rates below inflation. We also stopped spending as much in the 40s. The debt and the spending was an acute problem back then. It was wartime spending, but the war ended, and therefore the spending ended, or at least reduced significantly. And then the U.S. was extremely productive. There's like one of the most productive periods GDP-wise in U.S. history. So that's what people say when they what they mean when they say you can grow out of a debt problem. Mm-hmm. If you're productive, you increase your real GDP, you improve debt to GDP by definition. So the U.S. actually got out of very high debt to GDP ratios during that time. But now you look at, you know, what's going on. We're not actually reducing spending. It wasn't just like one-time spending during COVID. Yeah, it spiked up. We've come down a little bit, but we're still deficit spending like 7-8% of GDP. That is only something we've done in recessions. So debt to GDP is going to continue to soar. I believe inflation, you know, will it be 9% every year for the next decade? No, probably won't be the official number anyway. But it'll probably range between like 3-9%. I don't think it's just going to come back to 2 and stay there. And then productivity wise, we don't have that going for us either. If you look at what happened during World War II, we did things like the GI Bill, and the investments the government made were arguably positive for productivity going forward. We had a demographics boom, a lot of young people entering the workforce. Look at all the spending that we just did the last few years. Do we have a more educated workforce? Do we have a younger workforce? If anything, we literally have the opposite. We have people who are now more reliant on government benefits. We have people who got older and maybe said, hey, I could have worked for a few more years, but I'm not going to. So, you know, good luck turning off or reducing the payments that go out to Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, et cetera. So I look at that and I just say, this is monetary expansion. And I'm more cautious about investing in stocks and bonds because we just talked about that whole regime change of the last 30 years is now different. I think stocks probably do well for the next decade. I think real estate probably does fine for the next decade. I wouldn't want to be in bonds for the next decade. And I think things like Bitcoin and gold do well for the next decade. So that's like super high level, but that's kind of how I think about things.
That was really well said. And a point I want to really emphasize for the audience is that they cannot cut spending. We're getting so many baby boomers that are gearing up for retirement, and they need their Social Security. They need their Medicare. For better or worse, those systems are already in place. No politician is going to have a fruitful political career if they run on the platform of getting rid of those things. And then on the productivity point, we're seeing a lot of misallocation of capital, both in real capital terms, right? Because we had zero interest rate policy for so long, but also in terms of human capital, right? You're getting a lot of the young people. They're not going into the trades. They're not producing real productivity and real goods, right? They're studying gender theory and other nonsense at college. Like, that is capital misallocation. That's not wealth producing. So all this massive debt burden, really the only way out is currency debasement. And I 100% agree with you on that point. If you had to summarize basically in, you know, a few sentences, why would someone want Bitcoin over gold, over real estate, over stocks? Like, what makes Bitcoin the winner in this situation where currency debasement is sort of inevitable?
Yeah, and it's a great question, especially for those people like we talked about, the TradFi Wall Street types, because a lot of them say, hey, I can just, you know, buy my tech stocks and I'll be a good investor and I'll pick some winners. And like, why do I need Bitcoin? Also, there's the gold bug community. And I was a former huge proponent of gold. So I totally get that people, where the gold bugs are coming from. But as you know, there are some gold bugs who are totally anti-Bitcoin. So the question you just asked is, it, giving a coherent answer to that, I think, is huge for these different communities who are still not really open to the idea of owning Bitcoin. So for, you know, Bitcoin versus stocks, for example, or real estate, let's say, the more traditional investments, Bitcoin is a pure play on monetary expansion. When you own a stock, the things you're supposed to do when you invest in stocks, like you're supposed to actually do research in when you buy stocks. You have risk of like, you have to understand the competition for the company across their industry. You have to understand that the company's management, are they run by a bunch of people who are incompetent or frauds? You know, is there some sort of headline risk that's going to shut down the company? Do they have regulatory risk? You know, there's many more things, but you have to basically make it a full-time job if you're really going to be successful picking stocks. Real estate's kind of the same thing. Like, you have tons of liability when you invest in real estate, regulatory risk. You have to understand the market you're investing in. So I would say, yes, you need to understand certain things about Bitcoin for sure. And that is a long journey. That doesn't happen overnight. But Bitcoin, I would make the broader case that Bitcoin is a savings asset, a pure monetary play, whereas stocks and real estate, you're supposed to do research on these things to understand them. Now, the counterpoint to that would be people say, but I can just invest passively. I can buy a REIT. I can just invest in the S&P 500 and tech stocks. To that, I would say, okay, fine. You know, looking back the last 10 to 15 years, those have returned pretty good numbers, like anywhere from 8 to 15% per year. Just investing passively in like QQQ or SPY or some real estate type investment vehicle. But I would just say, again, coming back to the regime change that we talked about, do you think that the same trends of the past 20 plus years are going to hold going forward? And the people who think that their passive investments are totally safe, I would just encourage them to think, what would have happened to your passive investment in 2008 if the Fed didn't step in, if the fiscal policy didn't step in with major bailouts? What would have happened again in 2020 if we didn't get fiscal and monetary bailouts? You would have lost your shirt. You would have had certain investments that just went to zero. The only reason why stocks have performed the way they have, 10 to 15% on average for the last, whatever, 15 years, is because of those bailouts. So you are making a conscious bet that every time there's a big issue in the markets, the Fed and the Treasury are going to come in and support it, support the markets. You might be correct in that. And that's why, you know, I think people are okay owning stocks. But what are the effects of the Fed and the Treasury bailing out markets every time? They do that by monetary expansion. So if that's your assumption going forward, don't you want to own the asset that's going to benefit the most from monetary expansion? And then just lastly, on the Bitcoin versus gold point, which we can definitely get into because that's a loaded topic. But just for starters, I would just say valuation to someone. If gold is worth 10, 11 trillion are usually the estimates that I see total market cap of gold globally, and Bitcoin being 700 something, that means Bitcoin is has to go up 15x in order to match gold's market cap. You know, wouldn't, if they kind of do the same thing and play a similar role, wouldn't you want the one that's underappreciated? And this is a valuation framework that people use on Wall Street. It kind of frustrates me that they can apply it to corporate bonds. That's what we used to do. We'd say, this is a triple B rated corporate bond. They just levered up to buy this other company. That's why it needs to trade at a wider spread. But as they delever, it's going to come down to this single A rated credit, and you know, we'll buy it because it's going to tighten, the spread's going to tighten. That's corporate bond jargon. But basically, they could apply that same valuation framework and say, okay, gold and Bitcoin are kind of similar, but one has a market cap that's, you know, 1/15 of the other one. I think I might want to own that for some upside. But again, somehow that message does not land with the Wall Street types.
Yeah, you would definitely think that the Bitcoin gold comparison would click bells for people, but it really doesn't, especially when you consider that Bitcoin is, not only is it like gold, similar function, but it's better because it's digital. You know, how much better was the iPhone versus like, and the internet and blogs versus like paper newspaper and analog technology, right? There's really no comparison. Is it 100x better, 1000x better? We really don't know. And I love the framework you analyzed for stocks, because they are, if you're buying the S&P 500, maybe you don't realize this consciously, but you are betting on monetary expansion, because if they don't have that, a lot of those companies in that basket of stocks are going to go way down. And then also, I think there's like a level of opportunity cost when you're buying that, right? Because this year, market breadth has been so low, right? It's just a handful of stocks at the top that are actually making the S&P and the NASDAQ go boom. So it's like, it's kind of lazy at that point if you're just buying that thing, and when you could be buying the actual winners, the actual, you know, companies that are driving the markets. And when you look at a chart of the S&P 500 and M2, it's just tit for tat over the last few decades. So it really is a bet on monetary expansion. You want the fastest horse in that race. The fastest horse is Bitcoin.
This video is sponsored by Stampseed. You plan on holding your Bitcoin for decades, so you need to make sure that your seed phrase is documented in something that can last just as long. Stampseed's signature titanium plates and stamping kits do just that. If you simply write your Bitcoin seed phrase down on a piece of paper, it's vulnerable to fire, water, and all sorts of erosion that can happen over time. Make sure you keep it secure for years to come. Head to stampseed.com and use the code BLOCKWARE15 for 15% off the entire website.
You wouldn't walk down the street with a giant sign that has your home address on it. So why would you do the same on the internet? You need to use a VPN. Orca VPN is a service that encrypts your internet connection and hides your IP address, ensuring your online activities are private and secure. Orca VPN works on all different devices: Windows, Mac, iOS, Android, and Linux. Head to orcavpn.co and use the code BLOCKWARE, and you can access Orca VPN for just $1.99 a month. For less than the price of a cup of coffee, you can ensure that all your internet activity is private and secure. Again, that's orcavpn.co, orcavpn.co.
For sure. And I know it's a tough pill to swallow for people, because passive investing has been so successful. It seems like such a great thing. It's like, hey, I don't have to do all this research. I just invest passively and I can make my 8 to 15% in just buying US stocks. And, you know, everything's been fine. And that's true. But I would just really caution people, one, to say, you know, what has made that happen? I think it's the monetary and fiscal bailouts. And then two, like you were saying, when you're investing in those things, you just have to remember that if you're not doing the research to invest in those things, like, there's something else that's making them go up. And in my opinion, it is the monetary expansion. So in real terms, they actually haven't been as good performers as one would think. I mean, is it better than just leaving cash under your mattress? Like, sure, of course, you protected your purchasing power way better. But from a real return perspective, it certainly wasn't actually giving you 10%. If not to get into a huge conversation about CPI, but if the official CPI numbers over the last 20 years have been like 2.5%, call it, you know, I've looked at what other things have done: housing, college tuition, healthcare premiums. Those have all gone up way faster than 2.5%. So the CPI, I'm not saying it's like blatantly manipulated. I think they try to look at certain goods and say, okay, this, you know, box of cereal went up by this amount. But like, it's clearly structured in a way to remove some of the most impactful things in someone's life, like paying for college for their kids, health insurance premiums, and a home. When those things are not accurately reflected in the basket, the cost of living has clearly gone up more than 2.5% per year. That eats into whatever return you're getting in stocks.
Right. My mind went to CPI too. And I will say, I think it is blatantly manipulated. There's two things I would say are useful about CPI. One, you can use it to try to gauge what the Fed is going to do and trade assets accordingly. And two, you can gauge the trends of inflation, right? So having the basket of goods, right? If one good has like let's say OPEC cuts production, obviously, if you're just looking at oil prices in that scenario as a measure of inflation, it's going to be incredibly manipulated. So having all the goods, you could see the trend better. But where inflation matters is the goods you're actually trying to buy. So if the basket's filled with Kraft mac and cheese and Oscar Mayer hot dogs and all this stuff that's easily mass produced and doesn't go up in price that much, it's irrelevant to you what the percentage increase is. But if you're trying to buy beachfront real estate, if you're trying to buy grass-fed ground beef, if you're trying to heat your house, drive your car, etc., those are the rates of change that you need to look at specifically, and it's way higher than CPI. And you also see, like, the White House, they literally use semantic games. They'll say, oh, inflation is coming down, it's disinflation, prices are still rising, and they leverage this CPI, they weaponize it to try to make inflation not seem as bad as it is.
Yeah, and we're talking, I think it's literally the day after the video has been circulating on Twitter of the president and the press secretary talking about Thanksgiving dinner, and they had this line about it being the fourth cheapest ever. And I mean, yeah, the mental gymnastics that you need to make that sort of statement, like, they probably found some economists to look at it in, like, real purchasing power terms. Oh, show me the nominal wage, salary of an American, and let's find a basket of goods that could pass as a Thanksgiving dinner, and let's run the numbers and compare it in the past, and we'll call it the fourth cheapest ever. And it's just so obvious that that is not what people are experiencing when they actually buy food for themselves. And you just hit on another great point, which is, like, an economic fundamental point that I love to harp on, but most people, like, their eyes glaze over because it's just, like, very conceptual. But there's really no such thing as calculating quote unquote prices in the aggregate for an entire economy. I mean, Michael Saylor has done a good job talking about this, so maybe it does land with some people, but it's just, inflation is not a singular number to the 10th decimal place. It's a joke that we think it could be that. If it's literally different for every person, and even for yourself, your inflation rate is different from one time in your life to another. We talked about college, for example. When you're at the stage in your life when you're sending your kids to college, you care about college tuition. Right. If the BLS decides to, you know, not include college tuition or include some bogus calculation for it, then you don't really care what's in CPI. The fact that they don't include homes, like, why, that's going to be your biggest expense. If your goal is to own a home, then that's in your cost of living bucket. So yeah, my point is just that cost of living is a very personal thing. And we kind of kid ourselves to say, oh, look, prices went up 3.4% last year. No, there's no such thing as prices. There are individual prices that individuals look to buy. But you also made a great point that there is some value in terms of gauging what the Fed's going to do, and then trends. The way I say it is, like, yeah, directionally, it's true. Do we all know that prices went up since 2020? Like, for sure, we do. Can we say that prices went up by, you know, 20.1% for everyone in the economy? No, you're kidding yourself if you think it's that precise.
Right, because everyone has a different lifestyle. Everyone's buying different stuff. And you're right, Michael Saylor has made this point abundantly clear within the Bitcoin community that inflation is a vector. If you want to live in your parents' basement, not pay rent, and watch Netflix and eat Cheetos, like, your inflation rate is going to be very low. But if you want to do cool things in the world, and you want to eat good food, and you want to travel, and you want to send your kids to college, then your inflation rate is going to be fairly high. Jerome Powell has seemingly made it adamant that he is still trying to win this battle against inflation. We're getting CPI to 2%. What has to happen? Because you said you don't think it'll get that low. What do you think would have to happen for him to either A, like, pivot earlier than getting to 2% CPI, or B, for CPI to actually get to 2%?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I would say, generally speaking, I subscribe to the view that the Fed does not do victory cuts, that typically throughout history, if they're cutting, it's not because they're saying, hey, look, we got inflation down, the economy's doing great, there's no problems, but, like, we're going to cut anyway. They typically don't do that. It's usually because there's some problems forming and they're saying, hey, you know, we've held rates high for pretty long, and different segments of the market are coming under stress, so we're going to cut rates and hopefully kind of help the situation. So now you have to ask the question, what might happen that would cause them to do that? And this is another thing where I think 2022 caught people off guard, because a lot of people either weren't alive or they weren't following the markets the last time we had a sustained increase in CPI. And that caught people off guard, and they kind of thought, oh, the Fed's going to keep rates low. And again, the Fed was telling us that. They said, hey, we're not even going to think about raising rates until like late 2024 or something like that. That's what they told us during 2020 and 2021. That obviously turned out to not be the case. But people kind of believed it because they said it, but also because I think we had the recency bias of post-financial crisis. The Fed was looking for any reason to keep rates low, to not taper their balance sheet or do it very slowly. But it turns out the one thing that is a political hot button issue is inflation for people. The average citizen does not like seeing their prices go up, what they're viewing with their own eyes, or just seeing that CPI is relatively high. It's a hot button issue. It's one of the few things that central bankers and politicians in general have to be viewed as, they have to portray, we are doing something to fix this. So that kind of caught people off guard. But what I would say to your question about what might happen for them to pivot, it's interesting because one might have thought that in March of 2023, we saw bank runs in this country. That's a huge freaking deal. The fact that Silicon Valley Bank literally was having a bank run, depositors would have lost their funds if the government didn't step in on a Sunday, create a new emergency program out of thin air. BTFP did not exist the Friday before, and then on a Sunday they create it. They effectively increased the cap on FDIC insurance, because there are plenty of people who held over 250K in Silicon Valley Bank, but they were, the depositors were bailed out. Bondholders and stockholders lost, but depositors were bailed out. If that didn't happen, we would have had way worse bank runs across regional banks throughout the country. So my point in saying all that is, if you would have told someone, hey, there's going to be bank runs in the country in March of 23, most people would have said, okay, that's the credit event. That means the Fed's going to cut. Like, you know, they finally, quote unquote, broke something, and everyone's waiting for the thing they're going to break. And this was it. It was the bank runs. Turned out to not be the case. And the analogy that I give is the Fed is getting very good at having a boat, and there's like a hole in the boat and water's starting to come through, but they slap a piece of duct tape on it. It's not a real fix. It is not a long-term fix, but they're able to do that. And they did it, I'll say successfully. That's probably giving them too much credit, because I want to reiterate, these are not real fixes. This is kicking a can down the road. But they avoided having to cut, so they can still give the perception of, hey, look, we're increasing interest rates, we're fighting inflation. Oh, but at the same time, we're bailing out these banks and we're preventing a bank run. So I think, generally speaking, what would cause Powell and the Fed to pivot would be a clear indication that we're entering a recession, and that typically would have to come in employment data. And we could argue about whether we're in a recession or not, but I think it has to become like totally undeniable that unemployment claims are increasing, the unemployment rate is increasing. I think once that happens, and as long as inflation is like not, you know, not astronomically high, then I think you see the Fed potentially cut.
Right, that makes sense. And I totally agree that the banking crisis, that was, you know, could have been the straw that broke the camel's back. They slapped a little monetary printing on that with BTFP, increased liquidity, and we can live to fight another day. And I want to pick your brain on the Treasury market then, because is that the real thing that breaks and forces them to pivot? We had, you know, it was kind of a major talking point a couple of weeks ago, was the quote unquote failed Treasury auction. Yields have basically gone back to the level they were at before the banking crisis, which caused all that stress, all the unrealized losses on these long duration treasuries. And then another question to sort of piggyback on that, as you know, they're issuing more short-term debt and that has higher rates, could it be possible for rates to remain elevated, but also that be almost inflationary because they're having to borrow more to cover that higher interest expense?
Yeah, so I think in terms of what's going on in the treasury market, I still believe that, well, you could actually look at what happened in March of 2023 and say that was also an issue in the treasury market because these banks bought longer dated treasuries and those were underwater because they believed the Fed when the Fed said, hey, we're not going to raise rates until 2024 or something. And they said, okay, we'll buy treasuries. Those will be the assets that we own as a bank. And as yields rose very quickly, the value of those treasuries that they own comes down. And if the Fed doesn't step in there and the bank run keeps progressing and an entity like Silicon Valley Bank has to try to meet the demand for that, they would be selling treasuries.
Right.
And then as regional banks look and say, oh boy, are people going to start doing the same thing for us? They would have, and then if their depositors are pulling money, they would have to sell some of their treasuries or other assets if they don't own a lot of treasuries. So that would have caused a huge problem in the treasury market. You could argue it was a problem in the treasury market. But I think, and this is important, I think, for people to understand, is that we don't want to have the recency bias of 2020 during COVID. That was like blow the doors down, $1 trillion fiscal spending, literally monetized by $3 trillion of a Fed balance sheet increase over the course of like 3 months, I believe it was. I think we're highly unlikely to see something like that anytime soon. I think the Fed interventions are much more likely to be BTFP style. And they're going to say, hey, you know, we'll basically step in, create this new acronym on a Sunday. We'll buy the treasuries from the entity that, you know, needs the liquidity, or in the BTFP case, we'll give them like very attractive terms mm-hmm. on that allow them to treat their bonds at par, you know, whatever. They'll make something up. But I think we're not likely to see the doors blown off like, hey, the Fed's increasing its balance sheet by $1 trillion in a month again. So that's kind of my view on what happens going forward in terms of what happens in the treasury market.
That makes sense. And something about them doing these programs on a Sunday really gets under my skin. I don't know if you feel the same way. It's like, I just imagine them behind closed doors, Jekyll Island style, plotting, all right, the entire system's about to go down Monday morning at 9:30 if we don't do something. So we need to find a way to fix this.
Yeah, it doesn't instill confidence. I feel like it's 2000. There's probably some college kid who's having a similar experience to what I was having, because it feels similar to me in 2008. Looking at that situation, it's like, wait a minute, they just, you know, do TARP and QE when there's a problem? Like, that doesn't seem like a real fix. And there's probably some college kid looking at it saying BTFP on a Sunday and pretending that the interest rate hikes never happened, but just for these banks so that they can cover the deposit outflow and not go insolvent. It's like, that's probably raising a lot of people's eyebrows, and maybe it's making them Bitcoiners, who knows?
Right. Yeah, I imagine there was someone out there in March of 2020, they had a job lined up at Silicon Valley Bank, but they're about to graduate in May. And then they're like, ah, crap, I got to find something else.
That's one way to make someone a Bitcoiner.
Absolutely. So speaking of making people Bitcoiners, you work for Swan and you're in the Swan Private Division. I imagine you're having conversations all day, every day about Bitcoin, people interested in allocating capital. What sort of questions are they asking at this point in the cycle? And is the Bitcoin basically selling itself? Like, can you point at like, you know, hey, they see all this happening, they come to you like already wanting to buy Bitcoin? Or is it more they're coming to you asking questions like, what is this? And, you know, why do I need it?
Yeah, so this part's fascinating. I just love the fact that every single week I get to talk to new people about where they're from, what industry they worked in, how did they first hear about Bitcoin, what is it that made them care about it and not dismiss it, and then hear what questions they have. You know, how much time did they spend researching it, or are they literally on step one? And the reality is we get a wide, wide range of our new clients on all of those topics. They're from every part of the U.S. They're from outside the U.S., the industries they work in are super wide ranging. They could be a teacher, they could be a doctor, they could be a lawyer, they could have made good money in construction, they could work in tech. They could, there's a million others, but one that we don't see a ton of is traditional finance, like we talked about. There are some, and I usually get along well with those people because, you know, they're doing what I did recently, but that's definitely a smaller cohort for sure. And then in terms of like, how did they hear about Bitcoin? That's always interesting because it's sometimes it's a similar answer. Other times it's like a very specific reason that they heard about Bitcoin. And then where are they at in their Bitcoin journey is another one that's like, man, we get both ends of the spectrum. Sometimes it's literally a person who made a bunch of money, had a successful career in like construction or real estate. But then they've only heard about Bitcoin recently and they know they want to get involved, but they have not done, or maybe they're not able to do, you know, 100 hours of research online. So that's kind of where we come in. They're like, hey, I want to talk to someone who can kind of give me good information, point me in the right direction, be a resource when I have a question. So that's what we do. And it's just a really cool position to be in because it's hard to not be even more bullish when you see people come in every single week from all these different backgrounds and circumstances being interested in Bitcoin. And there definitely are cycles to it. Like last year is tough just because all the uncertainty and not just the price going down, but like various entities blowing up from Celsius, Voyager, BlockFi, FTX, etc. That kind of spooked people. And even though in hindsight, you want to be buying Bitcoin on the way down,
yeah.
The human nature, and it's tough, right? It's nobody's perfect and our emotions get the best of us, but there's actually a lot more people that want to get involved as the price is going from 30 to 40 to 50 to 60 than vice versa. And that's not to say, like, we still had tons of new people coming in last year, but those are usually the people, like, I'm talking like November last year when the price is below 20, right?
Right.
And everything seemed super negative, but we still had people coming in, but those people are the ones with high conviction. It's much harder to convince a new person at that point in the cycle. But what's interesting is that at this point in the cycle, we are starting to see those new people come in because I think they're a little more comfortable with the entities not, you know, collapsing in the industry. And then they're also probably looking at Bitcoin and saying, okay, this asset had a bad year in 22, but now it's up over 100% again in 2023. You know, I'll start to consider it again. So, you know, hopefully that kind of gives a sense of like who we talk to and how things have changed in the last year or so.
Right. Similar circumstances here at Blockware as far as selling Bitcoin mining rigs, right? At the bottom of the bear market this time last year, under 20,000, it's like the big cojones guys, right? They're fully convicted. All right, let's buy some cheap mining rigs. And then as the year progressed, as Bitcoin came off the lows, now we're at 35, 36, 37,000. You're starting to see more of those newer market participants begin to trickle in. How much has the ETF been a point of conversation? Because Swan, you guys have been super vocal about self-custody, not your keys, not your coins. Are your clients, are they looking at the ETF as a bullish catalyst? Are they asking you, why should I buy Bitcoin through you guys instead of waiting for the ETF? What's your overall gauge on sort of the heartbeat there?
I think they're definitely looking at it as a bullish catalyst. I think, and in my opinion, I agree. It's hard to see that being anything but bullish, at least for the price. Yeah, there's a whole conversation people can have about should we be worried if the BlackRock Bitcoin ETF or any ETF ends up having a massive amount of Bitcoin and that's the way that most people interact with it. That's a longer conversation for the longer term. But in the near term, I think it's, you know, hard to not think that it's a bullish event on the near term time horizon. And most of our clients are looking at it that way. So that's certainly top of mind. But then just, you know, a few other things like institutional acceptance in general, whether it's like Mohammed Alarian is talking about Bitcoin, even like Wall Street banks, some of them now have like a crypto desk where they'll like write research about it. So it's like gradually becoming more accepted. And then if there is a Bitcoin ETF, I think a lot of people will view that as kind of like somewhat of a blessing from the regulators. It's like, hey, they just allowed this Bitcoin ETF. I'll either buy the Bitcoin ETF or maybe now I'm comfortable going to a company and buying Bitcoin myself because it's been quote unquote blessed in the ETF. And I think as a whole, most of our clients will still want to hold Bitcoin in self-custody and not go through an ETF for, you know, all the reasons that you're very familiar with. But I think the ETF is good because it might be a lot of people's first touch point into Bitcoin. So I would compare it to GBTC in that sense. Like there were a ton of people who heard of Bitcoin during 2019, 20, 21, wanted exposure. They didn't want to go through the process of buying it on exchange or through a broker and taking self-custody. So they just bought GBTC. They were probably, if they held it for too long, they're not happy with that decision. But for many of those people, that was their first touch point. And then it caused them to have skin in the game. They learned about Bitcoin. And along the way, even if they held GBTC the whole time, they probably made an allocation of Bitcoin, quote unquote, the right way. So I think the BlackRock Bitcoin ETF might be similar. It'll give people this first touch point. They'll have skin in the game. They start to learn about it. Then they come to another entity, a Bitcoin only broker that can help them and actually get them to self-custody and all the things that we generally want to see people get to.
Right. I agree with all of those points. It's a Wall Street stamp of approval, and it's going to shuffle in new capital, which will cause the price to go up. And price going up is the biggest educator. So people, when they see the price of Bitcoin going up, they start to go down the rabbit hole. When they go down the rabbit hole, they're like, oh, I need the real Bitcoin, not the ETF. So it's definitely net bullish. It's like everything is bullish for Bitcoin. I can't find anything that is bearish. It's insane.
Yeah. And we just talked about the ETF, right? Just taking through a few more things. So the Bitcoin halving being 6 months away, I know that's a big topic of contention. People have their own views about how much the halving affects price. I would say at least historically, it has affected price. And then even just from a perception standpoint, that it seems to maybe be a self-fulfilling prophecy to some extent. But it's not a perfect experiment, right? Because like a lot of times in the past, we had, like, how can you separate out? Think about how crazy 2020 was. We got the fiscal and monetary bazookas in March. You get the halving right around the same time. No one can say, oh, this much of the price appreciation was from the halving and this much was from the monetary bazookas.
Right. So, and also at that time, you had record supply illiquidity on chain, which is another thing you have going on right now.
Right. So there's multiple factors. It's not a controlled experiment, but I still put that in the category of things that are more likely to lead to price appreciation in Bitcoin. We talked about Fed policy a lot. It seems like they're pausing at least for now, which is generally more positive for risk assets and kind of paves the way for future monetary expansion. I think just the fact that in 2022, you had all of those fraudulent or flawed entities get washed out, that led to a lot of selling pressure. That seems to be done at this point. And especially with the Binance news, that was an overhang that people were saying, oh, it's going to go FTX and it's going to cause a huge selling pressure. And now that it looks like Binance, that's not happening with Binance. We won't go into that totally, but it looks like they're going to be monitored heavily by the authorities and not go down the FTX route. And then, like I said, I see a lot of this firsthand, people making allocations for the first time. That's bullish for me. If 2023 ends with Bitcoin's price where it is now, let's just say, it'll be up over 100%. When you look at the macro charts of the last 10 calendar years, Bitcoin will be the top performing asset for 7 out of 10 of those years. So the years when it's down big, correct. But the rest of the years, it's at the top of the chart. And I think that'll make it harder for financial advisors, asset allocators in general, to just keep ignoring it. We have some great stuff on something called the Nakamoto Portfolio Tool built by Hafa Zaguri, our Swan CIO. In case anyone wants to check that out, you can play around with it there. I will throw in the Argentina stuff, not too heavily. This is more like a side note. I don't think Argentina is going to make Bitcoin legal tender tomorrow or anything like that. But having a more libertarian president who's very outspoken about the problems with central banking, I think that's just more likely to lead to additional awareness and hopefully some adoption in Argentina. So I put that in the positive category. But and then lastly, you just have all the technical things that are kind of innovations that are happening on Bitcoin, whether it's Miniscript, BitVM, Arc, Covenants, developments in Lightning. I think that's going to pull in, not only does it help Bitcoin from a scaling and usability perspective, but I think it's also going to pull in some tech investments. And I think that'll be a little bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy where more tech gets invested, the innovation happens faster. It also clues those investors into the benefits of Bitcoin. So yeah, man, it's you just said it's you know, it's hard to not be bullish, or everything seems bullish. It's a long list of things that are bullish for Bitcoin right now.
100%. That last point is under-discussed, in my opinion, and I very much agree with. In 2017, I wasn't around in Bitcoin then, but all the venture capital money went into ICO, bullcrap, altcoins that are, you know, pump and dump schemes or whatever. But now, especially after 2022, with all the crypto fraud getting wiped out, mainstream recognition is like, they're starting to understand the delineation between Bitcoin and crypto, especially anybody who's doing their research, and venture capital does research, right? In 2017, they did research. Oh yeah, you can make a lot of money dumping these ICO pre-mined coins onto the market, onto retail. And now they see, all right, that sort of scheme is over. Bitcoin is the real thing. It's getting adopted by mainstream financial institutions. This is the place to build. This is the place to invest. And we're seeing a bunch of wonderful Bitcoin startups, even right now in a quote unquote bear market. It's bullish, but like, we're coming out of a bear market. We're not in the heat and the mania. So I can only imagine how much capital is going to go into Bitcoin businesses in 2024, 2025.
Yeah, for sure. And it is interesting. You mentioned 2017, how so much tech and VC money went into things that, you know, Bitcoiners are not really interested in and turned out to not be long-term viable products or networks. And it's unfortunate because similar things kind of happened in 21 and 22 again. You looked at the numbers, and they're always estimates, right? No one has like the perfect numbers, but you look at the numbers for like Bitcoin VC investments versus like crypto, Web3, DeFi, NFTs, whatever new crypto tokens. Like, it just dwarfed the money that was invested in Bitcoin. But I think a lot of those people, you know, they had to touch the fire to know that it's hot. And hopefully they learned their lesson. But it's just interesting because it's like some of these VC investors, they were more willing to invest in like OpenSea, the NFT platform, or like the now classic example. I think it was a Canadian pension fund that invested in Celsius.
And like BlockFi, I think, too.
Okay, yeah. Like, you know, they were more willing to invest in these things than either Bitcoin the asset or a tech company that's building on Bitcoin. And who knows, maybe you and I are being too optimistic right now. Like, maybe there'll be another crypto-y craze that'll catch their attention. But we're hopeful that 2022 plus 2017 will have shown them that that was not the correct way to invest. And maybe doing things more, I would say, conservatively on Bitcoin, on a network that has much more staying power, maybe that's going to seem more attractive to them in the coming years.
Yeah, I would hope so as well. I want to jump back to the ETF real quick. Do you think, this is how I view it, the money that's going into the ETF is the passive flows that you've mentioned. It's sticky capital, it's pension funds, it's 401ks, it's IRAs, it's financial advisors, people that don't sell. They buy assets and they hold them. Historically, that's been S&P 500, treasuries, real estate. They just buy and they don't sell. If that kind of money comes into Bitcoin, could we see the end of these massive bear markets where the price goes down 50%+?
That's a great question. I think firstly, you're correct to say that a lot of the allocators will be stickier investments. I didn't mention this at the beginning, but my portfolio management time at Goldman, the channel I covered, it was always insurance companies that were our clients. So an insurance company, you know, you're paying your car insurance every month, right? The insurance company does something with that. They're actually a massive pool of capital that they invest,
right,
mostly in bonds. And every segment kind of has their ways that they come up with what they're going to invest in, like their asset allocation approach. You know, an insurance company is going to be different than like an endowment, like a college endowment, for example, because their liabilities are different. And then a family office, which is like an individual wealthy family, that's going to be even different. So it's going to be really interesting to see how each of those segments think about Bitcoin. So like, let's just take the family office, wealthy individual segment. A lot of them take their cues from like private advisors, RIAs. Like there was a wealth management division at Goldman that would have these broad recommendations that they would say, you know, we generally recommend, you know, X percent allocation to bonds or emerging market stocks or treasuries right now in this part of the yield curve. And they're always doing these like top level asset allocation things. It's going to be really interesting to see how they recommend the Bitcoin allocation. And you have to remember that BlackRock is one of these entities. If they have an ETF, you know there's going to be some of these asset allocators within BlackRock who are going to be saying, hey, it's prudent to have a whatever, 1-5% allocation to Bitcoin. And if that is kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy and Bitcoin does very well for a couple of years, to your question about, you know, do we see the cycles not happen anymore? It's a tough question. I don't have like a high degree of confidence, but my answer is that we still have some degree of cycles in price. And I think you need to separate out the adoption path versus the price path.
Right.
And this is where I would draw an analogy to something like Amazon, for example. So Amazon's adoption probably never really dropped off that much. Like even when the stock crashed 90% from 1999 to 2001, adoption was probably like gradually increasing that whole time. But the price went down because people got ahead of themselves. They just got overexcited. There was a bubble-like fervor going on and the price collapses. But the adoption underneath it is still going. That's kind of my view on Bitcoin price cycles going forward. I think there still could be massive drops in dollar terms, but it would only be after like a ton of adoption has happened underneath and the price has gotten really ahead of itself. Like I still think we're going to see 50% downward corrections in Bitcoin's history. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's my view.
Yeah. To me, that's bullish because everyone I ask that question to, they all say, yeah, we're still going to get these bear markets. So I tend to think Bitcoin does what we all expect it not to do. Although I'm sort of in that camp too. And I think fundamentally it has to do with the fact that this is a commodity and commodities tend to drop to the cost of production. Shout out Joe Burnett for the energy gravity thesis. It's like if Bitcoin went to $1 million tomorrow, they're not going to keep buying Bitcoin. They're going to buy ASICs and they're going to buy mining infrastructure. So all that capital that was going there is now going into Bitcoin mining, which is going to increase difficulty. Miners have to sell more to cover their operating expense. And that gap there, that arbitrage is closed over time. But we see cycles because of Bitcoin's adoption and because it's getting monetized that you still get these massive differences between the market price and then how much it costs to produce via mining. I got a few more questions here. One, I want you to explain for someone who may have listened to the early part of this conversation. They're studying economics at university. They're getting fed Keynesian nonsense all day long. Why is inflation and monetary debasement not necessary for economic growth?
Yeah, so this is a loaded one, and I did write an article on this. I love this topic. I would say that it all comes down to remembering what money is in the economy. And it's basically meant to be this thing that removes frictions when we're trading with each other. And my favorite analogy to use with people would be if you change the number of inches in a foot and you said, hey, there's now 16 inches in a foot, would that allow you to build more houses? Because, you know, that piece of wood that it used to be 12 inches, but now it's 16 inches because we just changed the measurements. Can you build more houses? People hear that and they're like, of course not. It's the same piece of wood. It didn't give you any more real resources in the economy to do anything with. It's very similar with money. Creating more money out of thin air does not actually give you any more resources in reality to build things with. And that's the real definition of inflation, by the way. It's creating more money out of thin air. Unfortunately, people have kind of confused it over the years and they use the word inflation to mean price inflation and CPI. Historically, it used to mean debasement.
Thank you for clarifying that. That irritates me so much, that semantic games they play. Anyways, I'll let you get back to what you're saying.
No, for sure. It bothers me a lot too. And it's also confusing because the debasement almost always is going to lead to price inflation. So like the two are intertwined, but it's really the debasement that you want to not have happen, because right. There's so many other factors that are going to cause prices to change. Geopolitical things, supply demand imbalances, you kind of want to let those work themselves out. It's just the creating money out of thin air that you don't want to do. And I get into a lot of spirited debates, I'll say, with people on Twitter who just firmly believe that you need to create more units of money out of thin air in order to create economic growth. And I think it just comes from that confusion that money is just this item that coordinates human behavior. And you don't need more of it to coordinate human behavior. If anything, in my opinion, I strongly hold this view that creating more of it out of thin air actually hurts the creation of real resources, because you're hurting the ability for people to coordinate and trade with one another. And then you could also get into this whole idea that when you're debasing the money, people spend so much of their time, even if their day job has nothing to do with finance, they have to spend some of their time investing now, because they can't just save money because it's being debased. So now, instead of getting better at their day job, more productive at their day job, now they have to figure out, all right, where do I pour my money in order to save, in order to not be debased? And it just like has all these negative distortions within the economy. So not only do I not think it's necessary, but I think when you do it, you actually impede economic growth in a huge way.
Right. And you could use the same idea for deflation too, right? You just want money to exist and not be distorted one way or the other, because it provides signals. That's what prices are. They're signals about real world inputs into the economy, and they allow us to make informed decisions as individuals within an economy. And so you hear a lot from the Keynesians, deflation is terrible. It's the worst thing that can happen. And you have to segregate between monetary policy induced deflation, where money printer, money vacuum messes everything up, versus technological deflation. We're getting better and more productive as a society, and that's driving prices down. And I think that's a huge, very important idea. And you know, shout out to Jeff Booth for really popularizing it.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because I got in one of these spirited debates on Twitter, this woman, Claudia Sahm, S-A-H-M, although I think the Bitcoin community has renamed her Claudia Sham at this point. She was being retweeted by Stephanie Kelton, and that's why she came across my Twitter feed. And she said something like the typical nonsense of like, oh, you better watch out for deflation, it's so bad. And I said to her something like, so you think prices need to rise forever or we have problems? And then she like quote tweeted it and was like, yeah, it's not what I think. This is a fact. And then I was like, I don't really believe that's a fact. And then I even went on to say to her, clarified what you just pointed out correctly, which is that I'm not claiming that if we have monetary deflation in a debt-based world, that would be fun. You know, that would be a very painful experience for everyone involved. But, and then I did say, in a world of sound money and commodity credit, as opposed to circulation credit, you can have stable prices or even falling prices, and it would be desirable. And to that tweet, she decided to block me. So that was the end of that experience. So it's unfortunate that you can't even have that conversation with these mainstream economists.
Yeah, I hate to use the word brainwashing because it's so overused, but it is, they're so locked into the Keynesian model, and they can't think outside of that. Because if you're a Keynesian and all economic productivity is measured on spending and nominal GDP, you do need prices to go up forever. Because if prices go down, it looks terrible according to these models. But that's just not how real world economic works. And that's why I love Austrian economics so much, because it's the study of human action under the condition of scarce resources. That's all economics is. There's more stuff, or there's more people wanting stuff than there are stuff. So how do we organize ourselves and behave in a way that we can maximize the amount of stuff that people get based on the fact that there's limited stuff.
Right on, right on. And I, you actually hit on a big point there. This is something that my colleague, Stephen Lubke, and I love to get into, is that economics is not a hard science. It's not controlled experiments where you say, oh, let's just tweak this little thing and tweak deficit spending by this much, and we know it'll have this impact in the economy because some economist 20 years ago ran a study. It's just, you can't do that. It's the study of human action. It's more of a social science than a hard science. Yeah, there are some like obvious rules, I think, or like trends or direct things that are directionally true, but economics is not a hard science. Unfortunately, people like Keynesians, like MMTers, they kind of want you to think that the economy is like a car and that, you know, they're the ones who have the ability to like push on the gas and push on the brake at the exact right time because they went to the right Ivy League school. And it's just not like that. It's a complex system. It's more akin to your body, as if you like tried to control your heart rate or your breath rate for every moment of the day. You know, can you do that at short periods of time? Yes, you can. But at the end of the day, your body's like this organic thing that kind of operates on its own, very complex. The economy's like that too. It can't be managed centrally, no matter how many people from Princeton you get in a room together.
Right. I like that analogy. And I would say that money would be the blood of the body. When you manipulate the blood cells, that causes cancer, right? That's a really good framework, thinking of it as a body, because it all has to work together, but you know, each individual part does play a role, right? You've got manufacturing, you've got services, you've got healthcare, you've got people driving automobiles, transportation. There's so many different industries, and it all fundamentally works together. We could go ahead and start to wrap up here. The question I always like to ask everyone at the end is, what does Bitcoin mean to you?
To me, I like to tell people that, you know, I'm one of the crazy people that believes that a world of sound money, because money is an item that coordinates all human activity, unless you're going to go live a hunter-gatherer lifestyle and have money not be a part of your life, you are affected by money, you use money to coordinate, then sound money is the thing that's going to improve virtually every system in our society. The economy as a whole, so trade and production, but not just that. I think it's going to improve art, architecture, healthcare, nutrition, food systems, energy, science. I think it's going to improve all of those things. And Bitcoin, to me, is our best chance at achieving sound money. So that's kind of how I like to phrase it.
Yeah, that does not sound crazy at all to me, John. And I think after this conversation, it won't sound crazy to the audience either. Where can we send them to find you and learn more about what you're doing?
Yeah, so Twitter, John_@_Swan. And I'm working on Wall Street for all those years. I never used my Twitter account because they don't really want you like doing anything on social media unless it's like got the company approval on it. But yeah, that was one of those great things about joining Swan, is that I can actually speak my mind on Twitter. And on LinkedIn, I think I'm going to start to get more active on LinkedIn, because that's an audience. I have tons of connections that work all across TradFi, not just at Goldman, but all across. I think I'm going to start posting a little more about Bitcoin. I'm sure some people are going to, you know, mute me or whatever, but hopefully the message will get through to some of them. So Twitter and LinkedIn.
Definitely do that. I made that shift about a month ago. It's super easy from a content side too, because it's a similar format to Twitter. You just copy and paste what, you know, your based Bitcoin tweets that are going to drive the Keynesians up the wall. Copy and paste to LinkedIn, and it's just like that. And they'll engage for you. I don't even read the comments on my LinkedIn. People will be leaving essays about how I'm wrong, and I'm not, I don't care. Like I'm so convicted in Bitcoin, and I understand that anybody who is educated, they don't have any critiques, right? There's no informed critique. So you're going to enjoy posting on LinkedIn. I'll make sure to leave the link to that and your Twitter and to Swan in the bio. I really appreciate you coming on, John. This is a good conversation.
Yeah, Mitch, you're so convicted in Bitcoin that you don't even turn the heat on in your apartment. So
yeah, I'm cold in here. Yes, sir.